From WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for joining us. Later on today's show, we're sitting down with Republican State Auditor Dave Bolick, who took office last year. While there's been plenty of press coverage of his new role as head of the state's election offices, and we'll say a little bit about that, I wanted to drill down on the main part of his job, auditing the government. We'll talk about some of the high-profile audit reports Bolick's office has released so far, his expanded vision for the office, and the perils of a politicized auditor's office, and his promise to keep politics out of the job. But first, we're talking about wandering officers. Now, many reporters who have covered criminal justice are familiar with this kind of story. There's a police officer or a sheriff's deputy that violates someone's civil rights, or violates policy, or even breaks the law. Sometimes they're fired, but more often, they quietly resign. Then, sometimes, not long afterward, or even that far away, they show back up at a new agency. But there's more to this than journalistic anecdotes. Carolina Public Press recently ran a three-part series on wandering officers, looking at some troubling examples, the systemic reasons that the issue persists, and some possible solutions. With me now is Lucas Tomei, who reported the series for Carolina Public Press. Lucas, thanks for being here.
Of course, thanks for having me.
So you folks have just released a three-part series on what are called wandering officers. Before we get any deeper into this, what is a wandering officer?
So a wandering officer is a law enforcement officer who essentially bounces between departments. They leave previous departments after either being fired or resigning under a sort of disciplinary cloud. They may be under investigation for misconduct, for example. But for whatever systemic reasons, they are allowed to keep working as law enforcement officers.
And we'll get into some of those reasons. The first story starts with the story of Mark Oakley.
Yes.
Kind of a disturbing story. So we'll have links to the stories on the page. People can read it. But give us sort of the paperback back jacket version of what happened here.
So Oakley is what we kind of called the prime example of a wandering officer. He was a police officer first at Roanoke Rapids, the police department there, and he actually resigned in 2015. We later found out because he had tased a handcuffed detainee at the jail there in Halifax County. And he later went on to work at several other nearby police departments until eventually he was fired in 2024 from the Warrenton Police Department, which was just a sort of stone's throw away from Roanoke Rapids. And that was because of an FBI investigation into multiple citizen complaints of him using his taser against people without legal justification. And his story doesn't end there, actually. After he was fired from Warrenton, he continued to work his part-time job in Littleton, which is a tiny police department. And he worked there for about a year until eventually he was arrested for federal charges for the same taser incidents. And so he was an example of someone that bounced between multiple departments. His police chiefs there kind of knew his past and allowed him to keep working and causing harm to the citizens.
And in one case, police chief actually said, well, I haven't personally had issues with him.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I think the public are probably familiar with individual stories like this, but you guys were trying to look at this in a more systemic way. There were some limits to the publicly available data here. I think like this was like the crux of part of the reporting was like, how do you get a big picture here?
Yeah. Yeah. So you'll notice if you read our reporting that our data is all from 2022. And that's not an arbitrary number. That's actually the most recent year for which we could get usable data to track previously dismissed officers that were still working across the state. So in total, we found 679 officers working in 2022 who had previously been fired by a past agency. But that doesn't capture what the picture looks like now. And a reason for it, which we may get into a little bit more in depth later, is essentially the way the state tracks this data changed in 2022, and we no longer know the reasons for why officers leave their departments.
Right. So I want to dig down on that just a little bit. Yeah, this change made it sort of, it wasn't totally transparent before, but it's even more opaque now. Let's talk a little bit about that change.
Yeah, in 2022, the North Carolina Department of Justice switched their database systems, and I haven't gotten a very clear explanation on their end for why their data tracking changed so significantly. But their data from 2022 to the present doesn't include what we called separation reason, which is a column in this data, which essentially tells us whether an officer had been fired or not. So if you look at the data now, you can see an officer's past agencies, but you don't know why they left their department. An officer who simply retired or moved jobs or left the industry for any number of reasons looks the same as an officer who was fired, which is really problematic for the data.
Yeah, it's a little bit like looking at someone's LinkedIn history. Like, you can see where they worked, but you don't know why they left. They could have resigned for good reasons. They could have been in the right. Maybe the institution they were working for was wrong, but you really can't dig any deeper. Yeah. Despite that, you were able to track down, you know, almost 700 wandering officers as recently as 2022, and you were able to map them out.
Yes.
Which I think is an incredibly handy tool for other journalists. We appreciate that. And even for the lay public, if they want to look around and see where this happens. One thing I think you can see visualized on that map is, you know, the preponderance of these officers are going to, you know, smaller rural agencies. Mm-hmm. Did you get a sense of what some of the reasons for that were?
Yeah. So one surprising thing we found in doing our analysis was there's really kind of no part of the state that's untouched by this problem. An initial hypothesis of mine was we're going to probably just see these officers concentrated in the most populated areas of the state, simply because there were more law enforcement officers working there, and that just naturally made sense to us. But that's not what we found. They're really spread across rural agencies and, as you said, smaller agencies. So what that tells us really is that these smaller agencies, which have fewer resources for things like thorough background investigations, they may have fewer applicant pools, and they don't have the money for things like competitive salaries, they may be forced to make a decision to hire an officer with a spotty past just because they have no other options.
That's definitely an issue you guys touch on a couple times is, you know, there was kind of an exodus, as you put it, of officers in 2020. And a lot of agencies are sort of up against it in terms of filling those ranks. I want to go a little deeper on that too, because you get into, you know, why would someone hire a wandering officer?
Yeah, and that's a very, very difficult question to answer because there are so many different issues at play here. But there are a few explanations that we kind of can look at independently. The first is that there's an information problem. An agency who is hiring an officer may not know that the person they're hiring is a wandering officer. That could be because they had difficulty finding information about that officer's past. It could be because they didn't do a thorough background investigation at all. It could also be, and we have seen cases of this, that this agency knows exactly who they're hiring, and for whatever reason, they don't care, or they don't think that officer will be a problem for them. They may think that the officer has learned from their mistakes. And we saw that with Officer Oakley continuing to work at Littleton.
The other question I think a lot of people would have is that, you know, every individual officer story is going to be different, but statistically, you know, are there risks in hiring, you know, these kinds of wandering officers?
Yeah, and it's a really good question because, you know, there is a plausible hypothesis that an officer who maybe is disciplined by one department may in fact be better behaved at their next place because they recognize their mistake and they've learned from it and maybe they won't cause any more issues. But that's actually not what we found in our analysis of the data. We found that officers, what we call wanderers, but officers who have been dismissed from an agency are significantly more likely to be dismissed by their next agency when compared to officers who have never been fired, and even rookie officers.
Gotcha. I wondered if you could touch on this part of it. This is a little in the weeds, but I thought this was important, and it comes up a lot when people are talking about accountability. And that's the difference between the certification and decertification process, which is the state, and then hiring and firing, which is up to a local agency. So break that down for people who maybe this is like their first rodeo with that.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is such an important thing to keep in mind when you are examining this problem of the wandering officer, because a lot of what we've just talked about is happening at the hiring and firing level, and that's carried out by independent law enforcement agencies. But the state actually has a role to play as well, in that they certify all working law enforcement officers in the state. You cannot work as a police officer or sheriff's deputy unless you hold certification from the proper standards committee, standards commission, which is housed under the North Carolina Department of Justice. So what we also found in our reporting is that the rules for when officers are decertified by the state kind of give these commissions a lot of leeway to make a decision. So there's not very many instances in which they must decertify an officer. There's no rules, for example, that requires the state to decertify if an officer is fired for misconduct, if they are under investigation when they separate from an agency. These are things that may be taken into consideration when the officer next applies for certification. But there is no rule stating that the state must do so. And that allows people to slip through the cracks.
Yeah. So the obvious question after all of this, and I'm really glad you guys included kind of a solutions journalism portion of this, was, okay, this is a problem. What can be done about all this?
Yeah. So the first thing that we recommended, which would be a pretty simple solution, is to just have better public transparency about all this. And that could kind of fix the information gap for not only the public, but also agencies. So we mentioned earlier that the Department of Justice kind of hasn't kept great data since 2022. It would be very easy for them to sort of bring back a public database, which includes when an officer is fired from an agency. And that might also not only be a helpful resource for the public, but also agencies that are kind of have the pressure on them to find out this information for themselves. Another thing we looked at was addressing this issue of poor applicant quality, basically, for especially these smaller departments that maybe don't have very high salaries compared to the next county over. The state has the option, and individual counties and municipalities also have the option to essentially give financial incentives to draw in better candidates. Now, of course, that is limited because it does, like we said, cost resources. So probably without state or federal help, smaller, rural, poor counties may continue to have sort of poor applicant quality when it comes to their law enforcement officers. And then finally, and a solution that has been partially addressed by the state legislature is giving protection to agencies who give up information in personnel files and internal affairs investigations. One thing we found in our reporting was that past agencies were sometimes reluctant to give up information about one of their previous employees because they felt it opened them up to legal liability, criminal or civil. So what the state legislature did last year was pass a law which essentially gave these agencies protection to give up these personnel records. And it actually required hiring agencies to take a look at lateral transfers past 5 years of personnel records, which is a big step forward. But what that law doesn't do really is touch on internal affairs investigations, which we know is another big aspect of this, nor does it really have any mechanisms in place to ensure that agencies are following through on this.
Yeah, one other thing you had on that list, which I thought was fascinating, because I've heard the suggestion in passing before, and that is, it is often the case where an officer does something that doesn't quite meet the statutory description of a criminal action, but a civil court finds that they are liable for violating someone's rights. And that's not directly tied in any automatic mechanism to like being decertified by the state.
Yeah, one thing we suggested was including in the State Standards Commission's rules for considering decertification is whether an officer's actions led either themselves personally or the agency or local government for which they worked for to essentially have a big financial loss because of civil court decisions. And one thing we often see is when learning about individual cases of these officers is it's actually pretty rare for them to be criminally charged and found guilty of a crime, especially for actions that they commit as police officers. It's much less rare for them to actually go to court, civil court, over their actions. And that's kind of something that has been overlooked by the state.
So I want to end on a, I won't make a high point joke, but I want to end, I do want to end on a high note here because you got a chance to speak with Police Chief Curtis Cheeks III, who's the High Point Police Department. And he took, I mean, there's sort of like a personal responsibility point of view here. Like as the chief, he took this very seriously. So I wonder if you could flesh out a little bit of, you know, what were some of the things that he was doing that he felt made his agency stand out? Because as you note, he was one of the largest agencies that had no wandering officers.
Yeah, in their history, at least according to the data. So, which they actually were not aware of until I found that out in the data and I told them. But what they told me was that that kind of matches up to their hiring policies they had in place. So what you'll see at High Point and some of these other larger police agencies, Raleigh, for example, is another one that has an exemplary record when it comes to not hiring these officers, is they have dedicated staff for background investigations. And they have these rules in place where if they find that an officer has been previously dismissed by a department, they won't continue down that process. One thing that the High Point Police Department does, which is pretty novel, is they have their applicants go through a polygraph test or a lie detector, essentially attesting to the truthfulness of the answers on their application. And really what that serves as, Cheeks told me, was essentially a deterrent for officers who may want to fudge some of the information on their personal history statement or leave out some things. And what they want to know most is they just want to have all of the context that they are able to gather about why an officer has left their previous agency and wants to work for them now. And what he told me is when these applicants get what he called cute in their answers, they'll do a little bit more digging and they'll oftentimes find things that these officers didn't want High Point to know about them.
Well, it's really great reporting. I hope people will check out the three-part series. But for now, Lucas Tomei, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Ben.
All right. Well, we need to take a quick break, but we will be back in just a moment as we sit down with State Auditor Dave Bullock. I'm Ben Schachman. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for staying with us. A few weeks ago, staffers from Republican State Auditor Dave Bullock's office reached out to ask if we'd like to sit down with him, since he would be in Wilmington for the day, attending a roundtable and visiting the field office here. I said yes, because Bullock is a pretty interesting guy. A Democrat until 2023, which is pretty late in the game to join the MAGAverse, he had once hoped that Democratic Governor Bev Perdue would appoint him to a state Senate seat. After a short stint as an assistant district attorney, he went into private practice, and he eventually served on UNC Chapel Hill's Board of Trustees, where he took a fiduciary approach to ending the university's DEI program, saying they didn't offer a, quote, return on investment to taxpayers, and that was ahead of the UNC system's more sweeping efforts. He's faced a lot of criticism, but also appears to be doing some important work. namely audits of government organizations. That, at least in theory, seems more like accountability reporting and less like partisan hackery. Now, before I get to all that, I want to touch on the issue of elections, which Bullock and I did not spend much time on during our interview, but which is obviously an omnipresent concern these days. I'll note that the Auditor's Office is working on updating and improving the software that elections officials use, and also the state's notoriously clunky paper-based campaign finance reporting system. We're not talking about changes to the rules around contributions, that would be a whole other conversation, but at least an update that will make it easier to track contributions, which is, I think, pretty good for the public and obviously a relief for journalists. But fair to say, when it comes to North Carolina's elections, most people's concerns are not technological, they're political. And look, the state auditor is a political office, and on the campaign trail in 2024, Dave Bullock ran a partisan race, securing the endorsement of Donald Trump. He hit some key conservative talking points on abortion and immigration and donned that signature MAGA hat at a rally. That's according to reporting from the Assembly, which, by the way, noted the contrast between the lower key politics of former auditor Beth Wood, a Democrat who was praised for her bipartisan approach, at least prior to her ignominious resignation. After winning office, Bullock took over the state's election system when the Republican-controlled General Assembly shifted appointment power from the governor to the auditor's office. By the way, North Carolina has been the only state to do that. The law that made that happen was decried by Democrats and sparked concerns about how Bullock would handle the increasingly fraught business of conducting elections, due both to his lack of experience and his political alignment. So far, however, there have been no election shenanigans to lay at Bullock's feet. Last year, Bullock appointed new chairs to the county boards of election, all Republicans, meaning those local boards all now have 3-2 Republican majorities. And, of course, when Democratic Governor Roy Cooper was in office, he had appointed all Democrats to chair positions, meaning they inversely had 3-2 Democratic majorities. Here in New Hanover County, Bullock appointed Jamie Getty, who previously served on the old three-person board back in 2016. That was when I first covered local elections for Port City Daily. Getty has, by all accounts, maintained a sane and stable working relationship with Democratic board member Derek Miller, the former chair. And under this new Republican leadership, Democrats swept in the 2025 Wilmington City Council elections. That election went smoothly, and other than one October surprise claim of vote buying that apparently went nowhere, there were no allegations of anything untoward. Bullock also faced calls to recuse himself in the recent Republican primary between State Senate leader Phil Berger and Rockingham County Sheriff Sam Page, which came down to 2 votes and sparked several recounts. Bullock had endorsed Berger, as had Donald Trump, but there's no evidence that he put his finger on the scale. Berger exhausted the recounts allowed by law, and in the one case where Berger asked for an uncommon hand recounting of certain ballots, the State Elections Board rejected that request. The real acid test, many say, will be in the 2026 midterms. Elections workers fear they will face myriad challenges: false claims about non-citizen voting, lies about stolen elections, the presence of ICE agents at or near the polls, weaponized public records requests, and the use of lawfare to stall and sow distrust in the electoral process. Bullock has promised repeatedly to, quote, leave politics at the door, and he'll almost certainly have more opportunities to prove that. In the meantime, though, I wanted to talk to Bullock about his approach to the meat and potatoes of his office: auditing the government. So one of my first questions is, with a big high-profile audit like the USS North Carolina last year, how does something like that get started? Like, how does that come into being? What is that process like?
Yeah, well, battleship is statutory required.
Right.
It's in the statute. So it is a regular routine audit by the team. So they do it every year.
Okay. And so this one year you happen to come across...
It was a train wreck.
A train wreck of inconsistencies.
It was just inconsistencies. There was turnover in the finance department. There was turnover in the leadership of the organization. And there was just sort of a lack of paying attention to what was going on with the finances. And so, you know, thankfully there's a year or every other year audit of the battleship so that you can catch it early.
Gotcha.
And it doesn't get out of hand.
With something like the Elizabeth City audit, mm-hmm. was that the same thing, or was that more of a tip line? How did that work?
So Elizabeth City was more of a tip line.
That's a $32 flounder.
Yeah, the $32 flounder.
And for listeners who missed this, this was an auditor's office report on spending by officials in Elizabeth City. The headline of the press release was $32.99 stuff flounder, fast and loose spending by Elizabeth City officials uncovered in investigative report. And I've said this elsewhere, but this did kind of remind me of the kind of nitty-gritty reporting that, you know, TV news and local daily papers used to do, where you'd have a journalist sort of going through the P-card receipts of government officials, sort of their government credit card receipts day by day. And we see a lot less of it these days just because, you know, newsrooms have been gutted, and there's so many more news deserts and so many places where you don't have a reporter who's got the time to do this kind of stuff. And so I was interested to see the auditor's office kind of step into that space.
Well, I am a former reporter.
Which helps. So that's why I'm saying this.
I graduated from the journalism school at Chapel Hill and was a newspaper reporter. I was a beat reporter. In fact, there is a cover of the Thomasville Times, which is where I had my first job, that I had every byline on the front page and a photo credit. And so I mean, you know, what we've been able to do and what we're trying to do in the auditor's office is provide information that is relevant to everyday North Carolinians and people who live in particular municipalities. One of the things we've been able to do is we've been able to ratchet up the technology in the auditor's office. So you mentioned the P card, which is basically the town credit card, right? You get your credit card, you put your expenses on the credit card. You know, in the old days, I like to say, which was 10 months ago, you'd pull the statements out and you'd pull whatever records the town had, and you'd lay them out on the conference table and go through them with a highlighter. But today, we're able to take what previously would have taken 2 months, and we're able to filter that down, and it takes 2 days to analyze now an entire municipality's P-card records, because we are using generative AI that we've built on the Microsoft Databricks platform. We have a partnership with them. And first time we ran our fraud protection or fraud flag generative program, we came back with a 23% error rate, right? The next time we did it, we had a 17% error rate, right, and so on. So it gets better and better. The technology is very powerful. It's going to enable us to have audits and investigations ongoing in more places across North Carolina. North Carolina's a big state. Uh-huh. I have 204 full-time staff members at the Office of State Auditor. We want to be able to, trust me, I know, everybody wants their city, their county, their school board audited. I know from the voicemails on my personal cell phone and from the tip line. So we want to be able to answer the call on behalf of everybody in North Carolina. In order to do that with the staff that we have, we've got to, instead of having 8, for example, investigations going, we've got to have 80 going at the same time. Right. So we've got to leverage the technology to broaden our reach. And so we're working really hard on that. You see the first P-card analysis report that my administration did was in Elizabeth City. In the coming weeks, you will see a complete P-card analysis in the city of Rocky Mount and the town of Cary and several other municipalities across North Carolina.
I am assuming you guys run the full record of the P-cards through AI, and then a human comes behind that and looks at the actual, you know, page 45.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, where you really leverage the time is on data entry. You don't have to enter the data, and the computer will pull the relevant data from the statements and put it to use, as opposed to, again, having to go through paper statements and decipher what the relevant piece of data is and then translate that onto a computer spreadsheet that you can then use to analyze as a large data set.
So one of the things I've heard, and I'm sure there are critics out there, most people...
No, nobody would be critical of somebody who's in elected office.
Well, I feel like if you stop the average person on the street and say, hey, they're looking into, you know, how your government's spending your money, I think most people probably fine with that.
Sure.
But one of, I think, the fair criticisms I've heard is that right now it feels kind of catch-as-catch-can as opposed to a systemic, you know, like you said, everyone wants their town audited. Everyone feels like their county commissioners bought something they didn't need. Their town, you know, their town all of a sudden has a, you know, a fancy new whatever, you know?
Right.
Is that someplace that the auditor's office can get? Is that the dream? How does that work?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fair observation that it's catch as catch can. You know, it's clear that from the time I took office in January of 2025 that we wanted, our team really wanted a new vision for the state auditor's office. I walked into 40 openings on a 159-person staff. The legislature appropriated 45 additional staff. We've hired north of 87 people in the office since January of 25. We've also promoted 40 people within the office. So long term, yeah, you want to be able to systemically look at things. But in order to get to that point, you've got to get your team in place and you have to get the professionals in a cadence and with and a way of doing things and an expectation of what our audits will actually show, because we want the audits to be relevant. Good example, I think, that folks will see, and this is not sort of a catch as catch can, it's the education, North Carolina Education Lottery. You know, there is something that our office routinely performs financial audit of every year. It is part of the state's financial statement, which is known as the Annual Comprehensive Financial Report. The findings and the numbers that are illustrated in the financial statements of the Education Lottery clearly point to the necessity of a performance audit. When you've got $3 billion in added revenue over a two-year period of time, yet basically flat contributions to public education during that same time period, if you're the elected state auditor and you don't start asking the question, should we perform a performance audit? I don't think you're awake, and I don't think you're doing your job. So in the coming weeks, we'll be releasing a full performance audit. By the way, the first one accomplished by the Office of State Auditor since 2008 on the Education Lottery. Because I think people want to know. I mean, it's not a question, Ben, of are we anticipating or are we necessarily looking for something nefarious? It is, what's going on here? What's the story? Because behind every one of these audits is a story. And with the Education Lottery, there are a lot of people I know because I travel the state that are really interested in what's going on with the lottery.
So I have to ask, going back to the Elizabeth City one, that release from your office struck me as, and maybe this is the reporter in you, as the kind of headline I might see in a local paper, as opposed to something, you know, more buttoned up and stayed out of the auditor's office. Right. Do you hear criticisms that maybe you're too splashy, put it that way?
Well, no, actually not. I think you've got to have a mixed bag in the state auditor's office. And with the DMV audit that we did, I pledged to the people when I was running for office that I would audit the Division of Motor Vehicles. We did. Most comprehensive performance audit in the history of the state of North Carolina is at least our estimation based on looking back historically. And that was an audit where, for example, one of our top line recommendations was to add individual license examiners. I think a lot of people would have anticipated on the front end that would not have been a recommendation out of our office. But the question we asked was, what is the best return on investment for taxpayer dollars when you have 350 people a day moving into North Carolina? You know, and that DMV audit, what I'm most proud of on the DMV audit, for example, is it's become a shared priority of government, and that not only the legislature but the governor's office and the state auditor's office working together to solve an issue that has been created in an agency that is the most public-facing agency in all of state government. You know, City of Rocky Mount, we just released a comprehensive performance audit of the finances of the City of Rocky Mount. And I started off the press conference when we released that echoing something I've already said here today, was, you know, a lot of people thought, well, this would be some sort of salacious audit. Yeah. And that's an audit that's just facts. Look, here's what happened, right? And that is a case where our team, the data drove them to the conclusions, and our team concluded what you had was a lack of governance. You had a lack of proper oversight from a city council. And Ben, I was asked by mayors at the mayor's convention, you know, what's one piece of advice you have after a little over a year in office? I said, well, biggest piece of advice I have to mayors and city council people, school board people who are elected to school board, right, county commissioners, if you're on an appointed board, and that is, look, err on the side of micromanagement. Ask the tough question, right, and require accountability on behalf of the professionals running the organization that you were either elected or appointed to have a fiduciary responsibility over. Because, you know, if the professionals who mean well and are doing a good job are going to relish the opportunity to tell you about all the good things they're doing in the organization, they're not going to run and hide from answering your questions.
So another concern I hear about this vision of a more powerful, more broadly reaching auditor's office is politicizing it. And, you know, you can imagine a future in which there's a Democratic auditor and he is or she is or they are recklessly going after, say, Republican-controlled cities and towns or organizations, you know, and trying to nail, like, a county commissioner for having an extra glass of Chardonnay at some kind of meeting.
Sure.
I mean, is that a safeguard you think about building into the system, or do you just have to trust whoever's in charge after you?
Well, I mean, I think we have a political system that calls upon, you know, folks to run for office. And if it's a partisan election, then you could have a Republican, Democrat, Libertarian, unaffiliated person theoretically elected to office. You know, elections are the best way to for the public to monitor that. You know, what I've tried to do is, you know, I'm an elected Republican, but I try to leave the – I do my best to leave the party label at the door. We don't talk about things in the office in terms of politics. I actually had somebody the other day, I was in a conversation with this person about something, and it had nothing to do with audits, Ben, and it had nothing to do with my job. It was sort of a personal thing, and we were having a conversation. And the person said to me, we just got to get things clear between the two of us. You know, you and I are on opposite ends of the political spectrum. And I looked at that person and actually said, well, okay, that's fine, but I got to be honest with you. I wasn't thinking in terms of politics. Like I think they're in today's world because I understand the political arena is very divided. It's pretty clear, right? Like there's a more clear divide,
yeah,
between political sides. But I do think, at least in my experience over the last 14 and a half months now in office, that individuals who are elected to the Council of State, that they don't necessarily think of things in political terms or view everything through a political lens. And we don't in the auditor's office. We view it through a accountability lens. So there'll be some things that our office delivers on behalf of the people by way of audits, investigations, and rapid response that I think should assuage any concerns about politicalization, because you know, you've got to be able to look at all public dollars regardless of what political party may be in charge of an appropriation or in charge of an administration.
All right. Well, we need to take one more quick break, but we'll be back in just a moment with more with State Auditor Dave Bullock. I'm Ben Schachman. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for staying with us. We return now to our conversation with Republican State Auditor Dave Bullock. So another big project on the horizon for the auditor's office is a look at general obligation bonds.
Yes.
And this is often a problem for reporters because the bonds are passed and then they're still being worked on, and you've had like three generations of reporters come and go. It's
right.
Hard to track it. But for example, the city of Wilmington is still working on, I believe it's a 2014 transportation bond.
2014 or 2008. I mean, it's been a while.
It's been a while. And you can only blame COVID for so long.
Right.
And, you know, it is one of those things that it is you, like the largest lump sum public money expenditure you see at the local level. You know, we're talking tens, hundreds of millions of dollars. And it is, you know, it is difficult because it's kind of people, you know, if it's a referendum, if it's on the ballot, you know, people, they vote for it or they don't, and then they kind of forget about it.
Yeah.
So when you're talking about accountability, what does that look like? Is it just completing it? Is it how the dollars are spent, the contracting? Get a little into the weeds here with me.
Yeah, Ben. So that's a good question. So what you're referencing is in the coming weeks, we're going to be releasing a statewide view of general obligation bonds issued across the state of North Carolina. And we're going to answer the question for the public, what happened to all that money your community borrowed? How was it spent? Because I routinely, when I give a speech, I'll talk to a Kiwanis Club or a Rotary Club, and I'll say, show of hands of everybody in the room who knows how the money was spent on the last bond you either voted for or against in your community. And there might be one or two people, and maybe it's the city manager or the county manager.
Sure, yeah.
But short of that, people just don't know, right? And so I think that is a true different vision for the state auditor's office to be a tracker of dollars as opposed to just a retrospective look back of these dollars. And again, it goes to what I mentioned earlier, which is about leveraging the technology to broaden our reach. So as we start illustrating how money is spent in communities that the community voted for and that that bonds were issued for, and we start answering the question, okay, this is how the money was spent. As we gather that data and report on just the facts, we can then see areas that need a deeper look, right? It becomes self-evident. Instead of going on a fishing expedition, we look broadly across the entire state, and you can start to develop patterns of how money is spent on general obligation bonds, and then maybe ask even broader questions across multiple communities. Like, okay, well, X percentage was used on consultants. And you'll be able to see a pattern across different counties and municipalities on that percentage ratio, right? And then so that can lead us to the tougher, more granular questions of, okay, well, let's get in the weeds and really ask what type of return on investment the people are getting for that particular expense of dollars. So I hope that's what you meant by getting in the weeds. I can go further,
yeah.
Ben. I mean, I can talk about this stuff for hours. I never would have thought I'd be jazzed to be state auditor, by the way. But I do enjoy the work.
I mean, I'm certainly interested to see how that turns out. I will not be shocked if we see the McKinseyification of government spending.
Well, I think there's some of that. I mean, there's also some good projects. There's hopefully the hope is we'll be able to tell the success stories as well.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about. And this is the biggest picture stuff. And there's been some attempts to draw an analogy between what you were trying to do and what Elon Musk was trying to do with the federal government. I don't think it's an apples to apples comparison, just to put my cards on the table. But it became kind of in vogue for people to talk about dogeing stuff,
mm-hmm.
Even in the corporate world.
It did.
You know.
Still is to some extent.
And that is something, again, that is certainly something when I stopped people on the street, irrespective of their party affiliation, they were kind of okay with. If you told them, hey, someone's going to come in and take a look at government spending and kind of go through it with a fine-tooth comb and see where the waste is, I didn't hear a lot of people kicking and screaming about that. My question is, like, can that be done given 100 counties, hundreds and hundreds of municipalities, thousands of budgets? I mean, the task seems so difficult for local leaders. Take one city or one county, you know, and they're getting this sort of high-level budget from a county manager or a city manager who's getting department budgets from department heads. And I've watched city councilmen, aldermen, county commissioners struggle to get their arms around something even close to a line item budget. It is just so difficult. And so I wonder, let me put it this way, is the dream of dozing dead?
Well, I don't call it dozing in North Carolina. I call it Dave. I'm joking, but it is true. Yeah. Well, they did pass the Dave Act, Division of Accountability, Value, and Efficiency. And look, you know, I came into office. We didn't start tenure in 2025 with a doge effort. That is not what we started with. We started with building a team, and we started with trying to take a look at how we can be data-driven. And because what you want is sustainable efficiency efforts across government. You don't want flash in the pan, okay, get a couple of pelts or a couple of notches, right, on your belt and then move on. What we wanted to do was have a sustainable program. You mentioned it earlier. Can you get to the sustainability? Can you get to sort of a strategic long-term look? You know, the legislature asked us in our first Dave report to take a look at lapsed salaries, and we did. And that was an interesting report. You know, the governor and I had some interesting conversations about it. But the fact of the matter is we did our report on lapsed salary, and lapsed salary is a mixed bag of dollars, tranches of money across state government. That includes how you pay full-time employees in North Carolina. You pay them with federal money. You pay them with receipts that are generated, like the DMV, for example. You pay them with state appropriated dollars. You pay them with some other grant funding. And then there's also this thing called a temporary or a placeholder position, which who in the world knew that even existed until we did our Dave report, right? And so... That has provided the feedback we've gotten from that has been, again, mixed, but the best feedback we've gotten has been from policymakers on both sides of the aisle of giving them in the legislature and members of the executive branch as well a clear look at what employment is and is not in state government. And that's the value of the technology, because we were able to use modern technology. We use the Databricks generative AI to compile the report. We were able to take direct information from agencies individually, that we received information from each agency. And these, we started with the big 49 state agencies. But we were also able to reach out to the Office of State Human Resource, the Office of Budget Management, and the comptroller to pull that data and make the comparison and put that into the computer program to get a real data-driven approach. And we've actually even updated that first Dave report for policymakers and executives across the state. And it is a transparency issue. It's, okay, well, this is what it is. These are the facts. You might not like the results, but these are the facts. And it doesn't mean that we need to cut every single state employee. In fact, as part of our recommendations, the team recommended increasing salaries for healthcare workers, corrections workers, highway patrol starting salaries, for example. But I do think that it's a reasonable thing to take a look at. For example, if you've got a position in state government that's been open 5 years and hasn't been filled, Can we common sense and realistically say that maybe those dollars could be redeployed somewhere else today to get some use? And we certainly can get rid of, and this is what the value of the technology been, we can get rid of the two positions that have been vacant 17 years, right? I mean, and the technology enables us to get to that granular level. So we're in the infancy stages of redefining the auditor's role, and I'm excited about where we're headed, and I'm excited about what we're going to be able to do in the area of transparency for the public more than anything as we move forward in the coming months.
So here's my takeaway. When I talk to people who, across the political spectrum, who
sure.
would like to see government be, well, they'd like to see their taxes go down. They'd like to see government spend less of their money. there's lots of different flavors, right? You've got your just straight up small government folks who just think government should be smaller. Kind of your corporate minded people who think government could be run more efficiently. You've got your anti-government people who think there shouldn't be government. So my libertarian friends feel this way.
Right.
I asked them how we're going to build roads and they change the subject. So where do you feel like you are in that spectrum? Like, are you concerned with shrinking government? Are you concerned with making it more efficient? I mean, how would you describe your sort of approach to all this?
Yeah, I mean, I think our approach, and I've been pretty clear on that, is, and that is taking the view of return on investment for taxpayer dollars. There is a need for taxpayer dollars to run a responsible government, to provide first responder, right? We need police. We need fire. We need ambulance. There are roads. You mentioned that. We need roads. We got to have asphalt. We need alternative transportation moving forward. I mean, there's a lot of work being done in the public transportation area. And you know, there's that debate of should we build more roads or should we build more public transportation? I think those are reasonable debates that need to be had by policymakers. So my view is, from the auditor's office, the best thing we can do is approach it from what return on investment are we actually getting? And if we aren't getting as good a return, where can we either be more efficient to provide a necessary service? DMV, for example, got to have a driver's license, right? That is a quintessential government function, to provide a driver's license, right? But can we leverage private industry to give a fast pass, for example? We already do that with license plates, right? You license plate agency, people may not realize that they're privately owned, except for two in the state. Can we leverage the LPAs, the license plate agencies, for example, to let people pay a little extra to get a driver's license quicker? That's not something new. People get TSA pre-check. I used it this weekend.
It's worth it.
Thankfully, it was worth it. You can get a passport early, yeah, with paying up too. So that's not a new concept. But I do think when we find areas where there is a government program, where there is no plausible explanation or metric to show a return on dollars, that's something that we at the state auditor's office need to have the courage to say, maybe this program should go the way of the buggy whip. Maybe it's time to move on from this because it's not providing value to the taxpayer, and we can redeploy those dollars to something that will return investment.
And at the end of the day, that's your job. You put out that information, and policymakers can take it or leave it.
Right. And the key is to come up with reasonable recommendations that are based on the data. And we don't, at the auditor's office, our team, we've got people that have been in the office for 30 years, right? They're professionals, what they do. Nobody in the office expects policymakers or executives in other parts of government to take our recommendations word for word every single time. But it does spark the public debate. With DMV, for example, it's become that shared value in government, where you've got the governor's office and the commissioner of DMV with the legislature through a mini budget bill and the state auditor's office working in tandem to try to get a result on behalf of the people.
I think the story there was that anyone could see the need by just going to the DMV.
Yeah.
It was very hard to go to the DMV and then contest that this was not a train wreck.
Right. Train wreck. I called it a train wreck when I was running. It was a train wreck. But now it's a shared priority of government.
Right.
And you know, look, did the auditor flip a switch and make everything all right? No. But what we did do is put it on the front page in the newspaper and on every TV station across the state of North Carolina and in every legislator's district and in the governor's front yard. And we all had conversations and got together and were able to move forward. Is it fixed 100%? No. But I think we're on the right path. I think most people across the state, and we'll be doing a follow-up on this to get the actual numbers, would say that the DMV is markedly improved. It's not there yet.
Hey, it's the DMV.
Right,
It's a metaphor for government inefficiency.
Yeah, but we could do better. We need to do better. Let's hey, Ben, let's be glass half full on that one.
Okay.
I think we can get there. I really do. I'm an optimist on that.
Well, Those are all my questions. I really appreciate your time today.
Yeah, anytime.
Anything else you want to go out on? Fixing the DMV is a good closing note.
DMV's great. I mean, you know, I love Wilmington. I think, you know, again, the battleship was an unfortunate financial situation. We don't want – I use the kind of the pun and say we don't want to sink the battleship, right? We don't want to do that. But our team has been working with the management of the battleship. We don't just go in and do an audit and then leave them out there hanging. Our team will follow up, and they're getting things straight at the battleship because it is an anchor to downtown Wilmington and to the New Hanover County community. It is something that is valued. It is part of the community. It needs to be there long term. So the financial stability of that. I would also say our work on disaster response has been and continues to be really important, and that's that broader, bigger picture thing you and I mentioned earlier, and that is the NCORE report that we did coupled with the work we're doing, and in the coming weeks we'll have several really detailed reports on the spending in Western North Carolina. That's fresh money going out the door. Has informed, and NCORE really informed, the need for an organized, uniform, predictable, long-term recovery system in the state of North Carolina. Every time a storm hits and there's a disaster, we don't need to stand up an ad hoc government agency to do the long-term recovery. There needs to be a way of accounting for the billions of dollars that we're ultimately going to spend on long-term recovery so that people know where that money is going. And NCORE failed, unfortunately, in that effort. $27.5 million computer program that doesn't work.
And NCORE here is the North Carolina Office of Recovery and Resiliency. We've done quite a bit of reporting on them, and I think it is fair to say that they failed spectacularly.
They really did, and yeah. And that's but we can learn from that. So let's look. That's water under the bridge, so to speak. Yeah. We got to learn from that, and we got to move forward. And our team is working really hard with other members of the Council of State and the Governor's Office, and the legislature to come up with a long-term framework moving forward for that long-term recovery.
All right. Well, Dave Bullock. Thank you very much.
Yeah. No, glad to be.
All right. Well, that's just about all the time we have for this edition of The Newsroom. Thanks to my guests, Lucas Tomei from Carolina Public Press and State Auditor Dave Bullock. And thanks, as always, to WHQR Program Director Ken Campbell for technical support. Music for today's show was provided by If These Trees Could Talk and Blue Dot Sessions. If you have questions, comments, concerns, or an idea for a future show, that's our favorite, you can email us at newsroom@whqr.org. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us for the next edition of The Newsroom.